Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It is May the 4th. We're continuing in Parshas Truma. And we are on page 450. We're up to the menorah. V'yasisa menorah zahav tohar miksha te'aseh menorah yerecha v'kana givyeha kaptoreha ufracheha mimeno yu.
Verse 31,
right. So the menorah, you'll make the menorah out of pure gold. Miksha, what does miksha mean?
Hammered out.
Now miksha means that we talked about miksha before. We had the kapores, the cover of the aron, and we said there that miksha means that which is not welded together, but rather it is one piece of metal that is banged into or hammered out into a specific form. So the menorah was miksha, which means the entire menorah made of gold was taken from one piece of gold and formed into it, banged into it, into this shape that we're about to describe. It's a very difficult way to make an item, but it is much stronger because you don't have pieces put together. It is one contiguous piece. So that it should be made miksha, which means this contiguous thing. Yerecha v'kana means its base and its, how do they say it here?
Shaft.
Okay, that's the middle shaft. And then we say three things. Givyeha kaftoreha ufracheha. There are three different types of ornaments that the menorah had. They were givim, which are cups, but these are not the cups that held the oil. These are just decorative cups. Kaftoreha are buttons, and just as it sounds, just a round button of gold. And pracheha are flowers. It's flowers. So there were cups, and there were buttons, and there were flowers. Mimena yu, all of them need to be formed from the menorah itself, meaning from the same chunk of gold that is being used to form the menorah. All of the ornaments of the menorah were not affixed to the menorah later, rather they were part of that gold and they were made using this process called miksha of banging the gold into a particular form, which makes it even more difficult. Every detail, even that which appears to be only decorative, had to be miksha, had to come from that original piece of gold. We are familiar with the shape of a menorah because we're used to Hanukkah. So we know that there's such a thing as a menorah, a candelabra, that holds various amounts of lights. And the one we're used to for Hanukkah has 9, including the shamash. Here, there's going to be a total of 7. And it will resemble, at least partially, menorahs that we might be familiar with. So the Torah continues, the shisha kanim yotzim mitzideha, 6, I guess we'll use the word shaft again, six branches. 6 branches come out from its sides. Shlosha kanim menorah mitzideha echad, 3 branches of the menorah branching out from one side. Shlosha kanim menorah mitzideha sheni, and 3 branches of the menorah coming out of the other side. Now they provide a picture over here. You have to bear in mind, Sugazunt, that the picture is only their own suggestion. It is not, as we like to say, Torah mi Sinai. This is not necessarily what it looked like. Their picture includes the various pieces that are described over here, but there are certain things that are not described in the Torah, which they are using their own imagination to formulate this picture, but it could be done differently. For example, you notice that the way they have the 6 branches of the menorah that come out from the middle shaft, they have them as curved branches. Sort of like if you take 2 of them together, you get a horseshoe. And one on either side. A larger horseshoe than a smaller one than a smaller one. They may not have been that way. They may have been straight branches in a diagonal form. going from the middle up to the top and on an angle. Successively longer branches coming up from the middle one. And so the danger of drawing a picture is that we tend to form that in our minds as being the menorah, and it was not necessarily the case. It is a possibility of what the menorah looked like. What we are going to see here is that there are certain things that the menorah definitely had. It definitely had a middle shaft with six branches. What exactly those six branches look like, I am pointing out to you, is not necessarily what you see in this picture. We also know that there were flowers, buttons, and cups. They, in this picture, attempt to draw those. For example, the six branches of the menorah come out from each two branches on either end, come out from a middle button. You notice there are three buttons there that the branches come out of. That is what we'll see in the psukim. We'll see in the verses that is in fact true. Whether it looked exactly like that or not, I can't tell you. But I can tell you that it did look something like that because they did come out of a button. In addition to that, there is a base. The way that they draw the base is a circular base with three legs to that base. That is a suggestion that they have, based on some of the commentaries. But there are other suggestions as well. And the base may not have looked like that. It may have had a completely different look of being the bottom of the menorah. So, although you can use the picture as a way of giving yourselves some visual, but take care not to allow it to bias you to any other possibility of what the menorah looked like. The Torah continues. Pasuk Lamigil, verse 33. Shlosha Givim Mishu Kadima Bakaneho Echad. There were three cups that were adorned. What's the English? What do they
engraved.
Say? Engraved, okay. It means that there were designs engraved on these cups on one branch, Kaftor Vaferach. And in addition to the three cups, there was also a button and a flower. Ushlosha Givim Mishu Kadim Bakaneho Echad. And another three cups engraved, not that the cups were engraved, the cups had engravings on them. Another three engraved cups on another one of the branches, Kaftar Vaferach, with a button and a flower, came a Sheshes HaKonim, so it was for all six branches, Hayotzim Min HaMenorah, that came out of the middle shaft of the menorah. So each branch had at its top three cups, plus a button, plus a flower. Uva menorah arba'a givim. And on the menorah, here when it uses the term menorah, it means the middle shaft. On the middle shaft, there were four cups, where each of the branches had three. The menorah, meaning the middle shaft, had four. Mishu kadim, that were engraved. Kaftoreha ufracheha, along with its buttons, and its flowers. So it's unclear from here how many buttons and how many flowers. It says four cups. Doesn't tell us how many buttons, how many flowers. This verse is one of the five verses in the Torah that has the distinction of being a mikra pasuk she'en lo hechreya, that is unclear where to punctuate it, which means as follows. The term Mishu Kadim, which is the middle of this verse, which means engraved, or adorned, or with designs, is that word referring to the Givim, the cups, which precede that word, or is that word referring to the buttons and the flowers that follow that word? You can put the comma before or after the word Mishu Kadim, before or after the word engraved. So, in the English, they say, they put commas in both places. Engraved like almonds is what they say is Mishu Kadim means. The word for almond in Hebrew is a shkedia, or shkedim. Shkedia is an almond tree. That's why they say engraved like almonds. But at any rate, the English translation also does not take sides in this discussion, where it goes. You can either read it again. Let me read that verse again. On the menorah, I'll read it both ways. On the menorah, there were four cups that were engraved. And there were also buttons and flowers. Or you could read it, on the menorah there were four cups. And in addition to that, there were engraved buttons and flowers. So this is one of the, it's Ela Echreya, it's unclear where to put the punctuation, where the word Meshukadim, what is it modifying? Is it going back on the word Givyeha, or is it going on the following words of Kaf Torah Ufracha? Therefore, when this is read publicly in the Torah on Shabbos, the Baal Kriya, the reader, should take care not to decide in the method that he reads which way it should go. Which means that he should not pause for a longer period of time before or after the word Meshukadim. He should make it unclear in how he reads it, since it is unclear in the Gemara what the interpretation is. So the reader should not decide that dispute by the way he reads it. He should either run it together or pause equally before and after the word Meshukadim. Pasuk Lamed Hey, verse 35. V'chaftor takas shnei akonim mimena. There's a button under two branches that is formed from itself, which means that it's banged out from the form of the menorah itself. V'chaftor takas shnei akonim mimena, and another button that is under the other two branches. V'chaftor takas shnei akonim mimena, and another button that's under the next two branches. So these are the buttons that if you look down the middle shaft of the menorah, there are buttons where the two branches meet the shaft. There's a button, there's a button in each of the three places where the two branches meet the middle shaft. And that's what's being described over here. This is true for all six branches that come out of the menorah, meaning the middle shaft. Kaftorehem uknosam mimenayu. Again, the Torah emphasizes that the buttons and the branches need to be from the shaft itself, which means they're not welded on, but rather they are formed seamlessly from the shaft. Kula miksha achas. They are all one miksha, one hammering out. Zahav tahar, pure gold. V'asisat neroseha shiva. You shall make its neros. What's a ner?
A light.
So we tend to translate ner as candle, which is not what it means. It does mean a lamp. And here we are actually referring to the receptacle that holds the oil. They used olive oil, of course, to light the menorah. The olive oil had to be held in a cup. This ner is referring to the cup at the top of each of the branches and the middle shaft. So there were seven of them. And you shall make its neros, its lamps, which means its cups, seven. V'ha'alonet neroseha, and it will bring up its lamps. How do they translate that? You shall kindle its lamps, okay? V'ha'ir al ever poneha, and it will shine on the again, this
toward
its face, okay. Which means that if you picture that's correct. If you picture the seven lamps, you have the middle one, and then three branching off to the sides. The ones branching off to the sides were tilted towards the middle one. All of them were tilted towards the middle one. So they were tipped in that direction. And the reason for that, our sages tell us, which Rashi cites, is that no one should think they needed the light. That would not be an efficient way of making a light. If you wanted to light up the room, you wouldn't tilt the lamps towards the middle shaft. What you would do is you tilt them away to give more light to other parts of the room. And this was to emphasize that the purpose of the menorah was not to be the lamp for the Mishkan, so that we could see. That was not the purpose. It was not needed. There was a light there anyway without the menorah. Let's finish up the paragraph and we'll talk about where everything is. Umalkacheha umachtoseha zahav tahar. And its tongues, how do they say it over here?
Tongues
and spoons were also pure gold. In order to be able to effectively use the menorah, you needed some utensils that could be used both to get the ashes out every day when they would empty out the cups and refill them, the lamps, and refill them with oil. And also tongs, that would be the spoons, and the tongs would be to manipulate the wicks when necessary. So you need those.
The top one.
No, they were large enough. They were large enough to hold enough oil to last the entire night, even in the winter months, which are the longest nights.
Mm-hmm.
So
big.
Yeah. So our sages tell us that was. I think Rashi said it over here. Let's finish it up first, and we'll see if we can figure that one out. How much gold is it? The Torah says, Kikar Zahav Tahar Yaseusa. It should be a kikar of pure gold. That's what you're made of. Eis kol hakelim o'eva, all of these utensils. U're'eva aseh besav nisam, you shall see and you shall do in their construction. Asha tamar e'bohar, as you are shown on the mountain. Our sages tell us that Moshe Rabbeinu had a very hard time with the menorah. Yeah. A very difficult time figuring out how to make the menorah. And there are two different statements in Chazal. They might both be true. They're not necessarily conflicting. Which is that Hashem showed Moshe a menorah of fire so he would have a picture that he could draw from in forming the menorah himself. And Chazal also say that at the end, when he really couldn't do it, he was told to throw the gold into the fire, and that the menorah would form itself, because it was impossible to do. The menorah was the most complex of all of the utensils, even the aron, even the ark. Well, the ark itself wasn't so complex, but even the kapores, the covering of the ark, which was very complex with its Kruvim with its cherubs on top. Nevertheless, the menorah was the most complicated of all of the utensils. And at the end, it was not possible for even Moshe to figure out how to do it, and Hashem had to facilitate its construction. Yeah?
It occurs to me that this throwing the gold into the fire and having the menorah emerge sounds a little reminiscent.
Yes? Very good. Excellent. Good. Okay, very good. Good. Yes, so you have to hold on to that until we get to the Egel Hazah. Yeah. Very good. Very good. Good. Yes.
Wasn't Betzala imbued with the...
He was. He couldn't do this either.
And the... whatever that is, the Titus, you know, Rome, that's carrying a menorah. Do we learn anything from that, or do they just kind of make a picture?
They took the utensils that were in the Beis HaMikdash when they destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. They didn't get everything. Certain things were hidden away before they came. Certain things were not in the second temple. We only had it in the first temple. So they didn't get everything. But they did get things, and it's very possible that they got the menorah. What's that?
The sculpture.
Yeah, I know. That's what Durian is bringing up. We know from the Gemara that they got the tzitz. They got the headband that the Kohen Gadol wears. That we know they got, because there was a machlokas. There's a difference of opinion what was written, or not what was written, how the words that were written on the tzitz were written. And one of the opinions of the Gemara says, I saw it in Rome, and this is what it looked like. So that was testimony that he actually saw it in Rome, which probably means the Vatican. So so we know they got that. Whether they got the menorah or didn't, I can't tell you for sure. It would not be surprising if they did. However, even if they did, that doesn't mean they got this menorah, because this menorah was constructed for the Mishkan, and it's not necessarily the case that that same menorah was still in use at the time of the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash nearly 1,000 years later. More than 1,000 years later. More than 1,000 years later. Now, we're going to talk about what types of menorahs are acceptable for the Mishkan and for the Beis HaMikdash. We'll talk about that in a moment. Let me just answer Mrs. Kaiser's question, because now I remember what the answer is. The amount of oil was a half a log. Chatzi log, half a log. So, do you want to know how much is a half a log?
Half a log is Right.
But of course.
Okay.
Do we know?
Yes, we do.
No, if you just say how much is a loaf, that would be.
No, you did the whole egg and loaf. You did that whole thing with us before.
Yeah. So a loaf is 6 eggs. So half a loaf is 3 eggs. So that's the, it's the volume of 3 eggs.
That's not very much.
That's not a huge, right? That was enough to last. Now, when they say that that's enough to last the whole night, of course, that depends on the thickness of your wick. The thicker you make your wick, the more oil it's going to draw, and it'll make a larger fire and burn faster. The thinner you make your wick, then it will draw less oil, make a smaller fire and burn less, more slowly. So it's hard to know exactly what that means with the amount of oil without knowing the size of the wick. But that was the amount that the lamps held, and that was enough to last even the longest nights. And as we've mentioned before, there was a miracle. One of the constant miracles of the Mishkan, of the Beis HaMikdash, was the Ner Ma'aravi, that there was one of the lamps that remained lit the entire night and into the next day. And rather than it going out, the Kohen had to actually extinguish it in order to replenish it with oil and then relight it. So it would remain the entire time. So the Hanukkah miracle of oil that lasted 8 days, that did not happen regularly in the Beis HaMikdash, but oil lasting more than it should was a regular miracle in the Beis HaMikdash. That took place every day in the Beis HaMikdash, that the regular amount of oil nevertheless burned, instead of only 12 hours or whatever the life of the night is, it went for 24 hours. One of the lamps. So, clearly, we have to understand a little more depth of this menorah, and as was asked already, what it represents, and to understand also the complexity of the menorah, why it was so complex, and the various pieces of it. Before I do, I'd like to tell you that after reading this whole paragraph, can we answer the question of how many cups the menorah had, how many buttons the menorah had, and how many flowers the menorah had? Can we do that? Can we do it without looking? Okay, let's do it with looking. Let's start with the cups. How many cups did the menorah have? Each of the branches had
three.
So 3 times 6 is 18. And the middle shaft had
one more.
4. So that's total of 22. That's how many cups the menorah had. 22 cups. Okay. How many buttons did the menorah have? Well, the each of the branches,
10.
Each branch had a button. Each branch had a button. Then, so that's 6. Then there was a button in the middle, on the middle shaft. There were 3 buttons for where each branch came together. That's 3 more. That's 9. The middle branch also had
a
button at the top, just like the other 6 had at the top. It also had at the top. So that's 10. And there was yet one more button. Now, how do we know there's one in the middle shaft? How do we know there's one more button? Because, let's see if it says over here. Because, I'm just pulling out the Rashi here goes through the entire thing with how you find each element of the menorah, how many there were of each of the things in the menorah.
Is it the same pasuk that we just said, the engraved like almonds?
Whether
how it's read, because it's knobs and its flowers again.
Yeah,
it
says it plural, so we know there were 2 more than the ones already mentioned. That's correct. So there were 2 more than the ones already mentioned, and Rashi tells us one went at the top and one went towards the bottom. So you have the 6. The 6, we need one on each of the branches. Then you have the 3 where they come together. That's 9. And the middle branch had 2 more, one towards the top and one towards the bottom, for a total of 11 buttons. What about the flowers? So again, each of the branches had a flower at the top. So that's 6. The middle shaft had one at the top and one towards the bottom. The same verse of
Kaf Torah Ufrachah, as Mrs. Kaiser just mentioned, that's verse Lamed Aleph 34. Then it had two more. That's eight. And there's one more flower that is not mentioned here at all. There's one more flower. Yeah, but where does it mention? So Rashi tells us that if you hold the place and turn to page 774, Parshas Bahaloska, which is where the commandment to light the menorah is written. Let's read from the beginning of Bahaloska. Vayidaber Hashem al Moshe Lema, Hashem speaks to Moshe saying, Daber al Aharon, speak to Aaron, and you shall say to him, Dehaloska tanei ros, when you bring up the light, which means you light them, el mul pnei menorah, towards the face of the menorah, Yairu Shiva Taneros, the seven lights will shine. So there you have again a reference to the light shining towards the middle. Vayas Kain Aaron did so. El Mul Pnei HaMenorah, towards the middle face of the menorah, Ha'elah Neiro Esel, he brought up its lights, Kasher Tziva Hashem Es Moshe, as Moshe commanded him. That's Hashem commanded Moshe. Then the Torah tells us a digression. By the way, in case you forgot, Parshas Truma, which we are learning today, but when you get to Parshas Baloska, which is on page 774, which is more than 300 pages from Parshas Truma, you might have forgotten the details of the menorah. So the Torah tells us, "V'zeh ma'aseh ha-menorah." This is the work of the menorah. Miksha zahav. It is one piece made out of gold. Ad yirecha, until its base. Ad pircha, until its
flower.
Miksha hi, it is miksha. Now the simple meaning of this verse is, no matter which part of it, whether it's a large piece like the base or a small intricate piece like the flower, it had to be made straight from this gold without any welding. It was just formed directly from the gold. However, our sages derive from here there was one more flower that was not mentioned in Parashas Truma. We derive it from here. Let's finish that verse. Kamarea asher hara Hashem es Moshe, like the appearance that Hashem showed Moshe, kein asa as ha-menorah, so he made the menorah. It does not say who made the menorah. He made the menorah, and the Medrash says it was Hashem himself who made the menorah. Fine. So now let's go back to Parashas Truma. It is a curiosity why the Torah in Parashas Baloska chooses to emphasize to us a few points that we already know from Parashas Truma about miksha and about gold, and why it would save one flower to be mentioned then, which is a very good question, and I hope we remember it when we get to Parashas Baha'u'llah.
Was it one large flower with the base?
No, it was a flower. It was a flower. So it does not, I shouldn't say no. As far as we know, all the flowers were the same size.
Okay. Uh-huh.
So at the end of the calculation, we have 22 cups, 11 buttons, mm-hmm. and 9 flowers. So, if you had to pick one thing that is emphasized over and over and over again regarding the menorah, what would that thing be?
One piece.
We mentioned before that the menorah is not the only thing that is made miksha. It's not the only thing that is made as one piece. We already had the kapores, the covering of the aron, of the ark, was also one contiguous piece. And there is something else that is also one contiguous piece. I think I mentioned it to you back then.
The kiyor?
What's that?
The kiyor?
Not the kiyor. No, it's not even a utensil of the Mishkan. We will have it also, actually it happens to be Parshas Baloska, but the other thing that is miksha are the chatzotzros, the trumpets that Moshe Rabbeinu, that were made for Moshe to summon the congregation. Those trumpets were also miksha. The Torah emphasizes they were miksha. But although the kapores and the chatzotros, the covering of the ark and the trumpets, were also miksha, but there's no strong emphasis on that. It says it, and that's it. As most things in the Torah, if Hashem tells it to you, okay, we got it. But with the menorah, it is said, it is repeated, it is repeated again, it is repeated again, and it is repeated again.
Yeah.
The message is hit home over and over and over again. It is to be miksha, which can only mean, I can't tell you why the Torah says it that many times,
But clearly, the fact that it is miksha is a definition of the menorah. It is not simply a method in making the menorah. It is actually a definition of the menorah. And it is upon us to understand why or what that definition is. So, what happened with this menorah? And what happens if you don't have all of the details of the menorah? Here we have a commandment how to make the menorah. It happens to be that there was at least one time in history when we did not have all the details of the menorah. The menorah had become defiled, and it was necessary to make a makeshift menorah to replace the real menorah. And when did that happen? At the Hanukkah story. Not only was the oil made impure, but the menorah itself was defiled. And they needed to make a makeshift menorah from scratch. And they managed, they expounded the Torah, and there was a discussion amongst the sages, and the conclusion was that although the Torah does prescribe this recipe for the menorah, but if we don't have gold, if we don't have whatever details are here, it is kosher to take, there's a difference of opinion in the Gemara, but at least according to one opinion, to take 7 branches of wood and make a menorah out of that.
So crystal is not going to be...
I don't know about crystal, right? I'm not sure. Could be that works too, I don't know. But the Gemara says even wood, which would seem to be, you know, you go from gold, which is the most precious of metals, and you've got this beautiful, gorgeous menorah, and then you make it into plain old wood, you would think that it's not acceptable. No, it is acceptable, at least according to one of the opinions in the Gemara. Everybody agrees it does not need to be gold, that if it's made of a different material, it's also okay, although it's not the best. But the question is, how low can you go? One opinion is even wood. Given that, we have to understand then, why do we have that flexibility? If the Torah requires a menorah to be constructed this way, then why is it also okay for the menorah to lack all of these things and to be made out of wood or some other material without the buttons and the cups and the flowers and all the beauty of the menorah that the Torah describes over here?
For the financial aspect and asking the people to use gold, that was impossible.
At the Hanukkah story. Yeah, to go find gold. Right, that was impossible. Right. That's correct. It was impossible. Here, they were coming out of Egypt, and after the splitting of the sea, they had a lot of gold. They had too much gold, as we will discover when we get to the golden calf. So they had more gold than they needed, and they could be asked to make something out of gold like this. But you're right. Later in history, the gold was not as prevalent.
But while they were in the desert, they had the ability to make these things of gold.
Because they had a lot of gold.
Yeah, right.
So then it just took a hot fire. To smelt the gold. And they made a big fire and they were able to do it. So the menorah, we know from Chazal that the menorah represents Torah. The menorah represents Torah, which is not surprising. We know that Ora Zu Torah, light is Torah, and it makes sense that the menorah would represent the Torah. The fire of the menorah also is meant to represent the Torah itself. It's true that the crown of Torah is located on which utensil?
On the Aron.
On the Ark. And we discussed this briefly, I believe, last time, that the Torah really has two utensils that represent it. You have the Aron, the Ark, in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, in the Holy of Holies, that represents the Torah. Then, in the Heichal, in the Kodesh, in the sanctuary, you have three utensils. You have the shulchan, the table, which we described last time, which represents the crown of royalty. Good. Then we have the menorah, which represents Torah. And the third thing, which we haven't gotten to yet, is going to be the altar, the golden altar, which will represent
priesthood.
The priesthood. So the three things that we know, the three crowns that we know exist, and we know the three legs that the world stands on, which is Torah, Avodah, service, which is the sacrifices, and Gmilus Chasadim, and kindness, which is the crown of royalty. Those three are what these three utensils in the Kodesh, in the sanctuary, represent. We have the Shulchan, the table, representing royalty or Chesed. We have the menorah, representing Torah. And we have the altar, representing Avodah, representing service. The Mizbeach, excuse me, representing service. Those three are then superseded or eclipsed by the Aron, by the Ark, which is in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, in the Holy of Holies, that represents Torah. So you have three utensils in the Kodesh, in the sanctuary. One represents royalty, one represents the Kohuna, the Kohanim, and one represents Torah. Then the thing that eclipses all of them represents Torah. Isn't that redundant? We have a representation of Torah in the sanctuary, but if there in the sanctuary it seems to be equal to the other two. You have three prongs, three legs to stand on. Torah, Avodah, Chesed. You've got three things to stand on. And then, when you look in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the Holy of Holies, it seems that Torah actually supersedes the other ones. So is it one of the three things, or is it over and above everything else? It seems to be contradictory. So clearly we have to say both are true. And how are they both true? So there are various ways of understanding this, but I'm going to make one presentation, which I think will be satisfying to everybody, and that is the following. We are here for the purpose of serving Hashem. That is why we and everybody else and the entire universe was created. It was for the sole purpose of serving Hashem. That is the only reason why we exist, is to serve Hashem. We don't know on our own how to serve Hashem. We're not born with an innate understanding of how to serve Hashem. In order to know how to serve Hashem, we were given a Torah which tells us how to serve Hashem. That Torah informs the scholar, it informs the Kohen, and it informs the king and everybody else. It doesn't matter what your particular contribution to the community and to Hashem and to humanity is. It's irrelevant. It is informed by the Torah. The Torah is that which is the overarching thing that everything else revolves around. One of the things that revolves around the Torah is the study of the Torah itself, which although it is a mitzvah upon everybody, the study of Torah, but the study of Torah as a singular focus, that is one of three prongs. We need those who are focused on the study of Torah to wear the crown of Torah. We need those who are the Kohanim, who are doing the service in the temple. That's the crown of Kohuna, of the priesthood. And we need those who are involved primarily in Chesed, in kindness, which is the crown of royalty of the kings, which is their primary job. All three of those things are the way to create and to sustain a society and a civilization that is informed by the Torah itself. Mm-hmm. But one of those three legs that it stands on is the study of Torah. Mm-hmm. So the menorah is not the representation of the Torah as the expression of the entire Jewish people. The menorah is the representation of the study of Torah, the intense singular focus of the study of Torah. That's what the menorah represents. In that study of Torah, the menorah is meant to be symbolic of several things. Number one, we have to understand that of everything that there is in this world, of the three legs that the world stands on, and all are important, and you can't say that one would survive without the other two. All three need each other. But the most complex of the three is the study of Torah. The study of Torah, let me emphasize to you that doing chesed properly is complex. Anybody who thinks that the performance of chesed is all it takes is a good heart, anybody who thinks that is foolish. It takes far more than a good heart. It takes a good heart and a good brain to do chesed properly. Because if you don't think about how to use your good heart is going to hurt people. Because it takes an understanding of people and an understanding of what their needs are and an understanding of how their what will help them, what will hurt them, what their egos are like, what their sensitivities are. Chesed is complex. Service in the Beit HaMikdash or what we do today, which is davening, is complex. It requires a great deal of concentration, a great deal of understanding and depth. But of all three, the other two are not as complex as the study of Torah itself. The study of Torah itself supersedes all of them in its complexity. It is extremely, extremely complex. And the depth of complexity supersedes the rest. Yes? You have a question? No.
I have.
Yes?
Since Abram was, his number one thing was Keshet, then who guided him? Was it Hashem that actually...
I mean, that's a good question. How did Avraham know how to do Chesed properly?
Yeah.
That's a good question.
He was real popular for that.
Yeah, that's a very good question. So there we have to say that he was able, in his greatness, he was able to figure out how to do it. That, but you're right, that would not be a simple matter, and somehow our patriarchs and matriarchs did have some access to the knowledge of Torah. And that's true, although they were not given the Torah the way we were given the Torah. Yeah?
Okay, so a related question, that every test that Abraham went through, did it increase his level of Torah and ability to do chesed?
It increased his chesed. At the end of the day, the greatest of his tests was whether he would sacrifice his son, which you would think is anti-chesed. But a person who is really a Baal Chesed knows that sometimes chesed doesn't feel so good. It doesn't have to feel good to be good chesed. We shouldn't confuse what makes me feel good to what is really chesed. In this complexity of Torah that the menorah represents, it is so complex that even Moshe Rabbeinu, who is the teacher of the Torah, every detail and knowledge of Torah that we have ultimately accrues to Moshe. Whether Moshe actually said these words or not is irrelevant, because it's all built on whatever it is that Moshe taught us. There's nothing that we can understand in Torah that doesn't ultimately go back to Moshe's presentation of the Torah to the Jewish people. Moshe is Rabbeinu. He's the teacher. He's the Rebbe of everybody. And even Moshe couldn't grasp the menorah. The full, complete body of the Torah, in all its complexity, even eluded Moshe Rabbeinu. If it eluded Moshe Rabbeinu, then we all have to have a very healthy dose of humility when we study the Torah. And to be aware of the fact that we can reach great and very... great in-depth understandings of the Torah, but it's not a full understanding of the Torah. We're always going to fall short because there's always another layer that even Moshe couldn't get to. So certainly we're not getting to everything. The Torah, when it is studied in this manner, when it really is understood as well as a human being can understand it, it is beautiful. It's the most beautiful of all the utensils. It's gorgeous. It's this beautiful gold with all the ornate decorations and the engravings. It's a beautiful, beautiful masterpiece once it is fully grasped. But it must be miksha. It must all come from one piece. You can't take one piece and then affix another piece to it. You can't start banging in pieces. You can't start welding pieces. It's one hunk of gold which you form. Now, when you do that, think about this for a moment. I realize that the most significant thing of that, as I mentioned before, is that it's powerful, it's strong, it doesn't fall apart. But there's another very, very important aspect to that. If I can make pieces and affix them, then I can make something that looks like it's going to be a menorah. I can take different pieces, and you see here's the middle shaft. I form that first. Then I take a branch, I bang it in, take another branch, I bang that in. I've got now a middle shaft and two branches. It's starting to look like a menorah. I take a little flower, I bang it on, I weld on a little button. It's starting to look like a beautiful thing. You see it as it's happening, and it seems sequential, and you can grasp part of it as it go along. But if you are taking one hunk of gold and trying to formulate this thing, aside from the complexity, it doesn't look like much at first. It looks like a mess. It looks like one glob, which is a mess, and as you're forming, it doesn't have this beauty to it. And you probably have to form it and then redo it, because I used too much gold over here, so there wasn't enough gold left for over there, and I can't go bring more gold. It's one kikar of gold. That's it. That's all I got. So I've got to take one kikar of gold and I've got to formulate it into this menorah. And if I use a little too much gold on this flower and a little too little gold on that button, well, then it's going to be lopsided. Mm-hmm. So I got to reformulate it. So it's something which it is a beautiful and complex, but it takes a lot of time, a lot of effort, and it won't necessarily look beautiful in the beginning. And it takes a long time before it really starts to have a shape and a beauty that people can appreciate. This is very important for understanding even our contemporary study halls, places where people are studying and learning Torah. When you have young men who are sitting and trying to acquire Torah, you're not going to be able to say at the outset, what can this person contribute right now to general society with Torah? Not much, because it takes a long time and a lot of years of effort before a person's Torah can really be something that can then shine forth. It's not something that just in a couple of years, all of a sudden, the person's contributing. What I mean to say is, all endeavors take many years before a person is an expert. But in Torah, if you're not an expert, then you can't just be halfway there. Halfway there is still not enough to be able to give forth to others. It takes expertise to become one who can present. Let me just make a couple of other points because we're really almost out of time. At the same time, we also have to understand that the Torah, because of how important it is that we have the study of Torah, and because we can live in a society where the priesthood, the kohuna, is essentially non-existent. It's not that we don't have kohanim, but they're not serving because we don't have a Beis HaMikdash. The royalty is non-existent. We have a descendant of King David somewhere, but he's not functioning as king. But Torah is the constant that we always have to have. Even when you can't reach that beauty, when you can't reach that complexity, and you've got to slap together some wood to make a menorah, you got to have the menorah. You got to have the Torah. Even if you're settling for less than what the Torah here describes, we have to know that we're settling. We have to know that this is not what ultimately the Torah is meant to be, but we still have to hold on to it. It's a constant that can never... We as a people cannot survive without it. Even if it just means slapping together a few boards to make some makeshift menorah. But we got to have the menorah. That's the one thing that's got to go with us all the time. All the time.
For those of you who do catch up online, with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.